Do you believe that there is a fundamentally sound business at the end of this tunnel that you can't see the light at yet? And if the answer is yes, then it's worth fighting for.
I'm your host, Dave Knox, and this is Predicting the Turn, a show that helps business leaders meet their industry's inevitable disruption head on.
Welcome to another episode of Predicting the Turn. Today, we sit down with Nick Bodkins, who is the founder of Boisson. Nick, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dave.
So I want to start with the story of the business. For those not familiar with your journey, can you tell me about the founding of the company and what you were building?
Yeah, if you put yourself back in 2020, imagine my wife and I are sitting on the couch in the middle of COVID. We were actually supposed to start our IVF journey towards having a family about 2 weeks after COVID started, and that was delayed quite a bit. We started in October of 2020, and I'm like not drinking. My wife's obviously not drinking during that process, and she basically turned to me one night and was like, I need a Negroni really bad. And the reason why she said that was that like Thursday nights were our cathartic pre-weekend ritual of having a Negroni, and I had all the sort of red vermouths and gins and everything, and we would mix it all up. And obviously what she was looking for during this time, which for those people, anybody that's been through it, you don't really feel like you have a lot of control over anything during IVF. You know, you're waiting on a nurse to call and tell her exactly what to do every single day, and there's monitoring and blood work and all this stuff. I wanted some sense of normalcy. And what I found myself doing was like, okay, like I'm a problem solver. I'm like an ops and marketing. Okay, like I'm going to find you a non-option. And I hadn't really been exposed to this cut from whole cloth new industry at all. And what I found when I started Googling and started trying to find her options were basically like a bunch of brands trying to sell me non-products. Like my day job, I worked at a customer data platform and was working with a lot of consumer brands. And it's like, if you want to buy a mattress in a bag, like they can describe to you how soft it is, but you don't really know until you sit down on it. That's the reason why Casper opened stores and why all these mattress companies are like opening stores. And what I found when I went searching for the ingredients was basically three different companies, a non-alc gin, a non-alc vermouth, and a non-alc Campari. And they all were spending ad money to try to get me to their site. They all wanted me to buy a case at a time because that's how it made sense for them to sell it to me. And what I found myself doing was basically just like this frustration of like three different companies, three different ingredients to make one cocktail. And as you would imagine with someone in growth marketing and retention marketing, like I'm starting to dig deeper into this after I solved the problem of like getting my wife a non-alc Negroni. But it really started to hit me like a lot of these brands that I was finding online had developed over 2017, 2018, 2019. These founders had been like building these non-alcoholic alternatives that were fundamentally different than what existed in the market. And they were all planning on launching into bars and restaurants and on-premise establishments in 2020. And they all now had to pivot to direct to consumer. And so that was the jumping off point for what exactly is the problem here. And the problem was really that the buying experience should feel a lot more like going to a wine in a liquor store. Or in our case, what we were moving towards was how do you create like the Sephora experience for non-alc, which is you may not know exactly what you're looking for, but you do know maybe an ingredient or something else about the product in the same way that when you go to Sephora, you may not be searching by brand, but it's like, I have oily skin or I need something for my hair, or like whatever it is. And you've got knowledgeable people that understand all the brands and the products and whatnot. So that was the origin story. And then it just went from there.
So fast forward from those early days, earlier this year, you had some issues with the business. What happened there?
Yeah. So again, putting yourself back in that mindset of like where the consumer space was, we saw a huge problem in this category. And that was that getting sips to lips, which is the age-old industry term of getting people to try the product for the first time, this category was hamstrung by a number of things, not the least of which, when you think about how you would sell this into where you would typically go a product like this, like a grocery store, like a wine and spirits retailer, where we lived in New York City, wine and spirits not allowed to sell non-alcoholic products, believe it or not. Like you can't sell gin and tonic in the same store. You have to go to two different stores to buy them. And our sort of thesis from the beginning, which was buoyed by a tremendous interest from the investing community was that we needed to build the three-legged stool, which was a retail component, like a specialty retail component that sort of mimics this sort of Sephora buying experience, which is what I described to you, and building that out at scale. The second one was a multifaceted e-commerce marketplace, which we initially were able to fulfill through our stores and then quickly got too big. And then the last component, which came later with some of our additional funding, was how do we build a wholesale component? Because in the same way that it's hard to think about how grocery and wine and spirits retailers are going to market the product to consumers on their shelves and how they get purchased, the same can be said about existing wine and spirits and beer wholesalers that are selling into those businesses. And is the alcohol business poised to be the best seller of non-alcoholic products? And our thesis was that they weren't. Now, the sort of fast forward piece there is we did build an 11-store retail business in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Miami. The retail stores were incredibly difficult to run, lots and lots of resource requirements behind that. We built this massive warehouse infrastructure because there was a lot of interest in us getting 25, 35, 40 stores. And the resources required to run the warehousing infrastructure. And the bottom line was that, thankfully, for the broader category, retailers figured out how to build their thesis around how to sell these products a lot faster than I think a lot of people expected that was going to be the case. And the need for specialty retail, not necessarily, and we can talk about this a little bit more, but not necessarily the state. Own non-alcoholic bottle shop that's run by the person that founded it or opened it, but not so much this formulaic approach is just largely not necessary in 2024 because of the wide availability of these products in other retailers. And our business basically ran into a crisis of an investment community looking for a business that could reach profitability really quickly. And our business was based on scale, and we were getting closer to that profitability at the scale that we were at, but with a ton of overhead and fixed costs associated with it, which really concerned an investing community that looked at businesses like ours very differently than they did in 2021 and 2022. And we just ran into headwinds of the last $5 or $6 million that we were going to need to get profitable. And it unfortunately meant that we were just in a position of having to reorganize the business. And thankfully, we've been able to do that. But it has been one of the most profound and difficult challenges of my life to navigate this. And frankly, a huge disappointment for me, for the investors, for the friends of mine that have invested in the business, et cetera. But coming out on the other side of this was not a guarantee. It's something that took an incredible amount of work over the last 6 months or so.
I want to dive into that a little bit more because in the startup world, unfortunately, more startups fail than succeed. But yeah. Usually failure is the shutting down of the business, the end of what they were doing, yeah. And maybe an acqui-hire or a soft landing, as you'll hear in the investor terms. It's unique that you went through bankruptcy and now you're coming out on the other side. So what led you to that path and how did you approach it differently than call it the typical startup journey?
I think that the really important difference here is that what happens in the startup space is something along the lines of, well, you have a product that some people like, but doesn't have broad enough product market fit, and we don't ever really see it getting to that point. The non-alcoholic drinks category is one of the only categories growing in the beverage space, and it's growing at like a 30% CAGR, like really crazy numbers. 5 years ago is less than $150 million. Last year is $750 million off-premise only just in the United States. It'll probably be this year that it crosses $1 billion. So we were in a category with a ton of tailwinds. What the challenge became was how quickly could we build a business that was not reliant on outside capital to self-sustain? And the reorganization pathway for us was not a given. In fact, when we talked to our bankruptcy counsel and I explained to them, I think there still may be a real business here. I want to try to figure out how to do this the right way. And is there a way that we can actually come out on the other side of this with some upside for the brands we work with, for the investors that have put their faith in us, et cetera. The council basically said to us, listen, like, I think it's a worthwhile exercise. You've got about a half a percent chance. I see this happen in about 1 out of 200 companies that come to us that go through the bankruptcy process. There are some nuances that, like, you may or may not care to get into about what we were able to go through that, like, actually made it slightly more palatable and possible. But the process itself was linear in the sense that we had a starting date that we knew we were going to need to file. And there was an end that either ended with the liquidation of the business or it emerging as a reorganized business. And the in-between were a number of discrete decisions and concessions and agreements that would have to be made by many different entities with many different motivations that all had to happen in exact right order for it to happen. And that, I think, was the part where my direction as a founder, after firing myself as an employee and everyone else in the company, was to say, do I want to go pursue what you just suggested, which is go find a job at a big conglomerate or a company that's looking for expertise in ALK and just say, hey, that was a good shot and we gave it a shot and that's it, or not? And I think that the motivating piece for me was, you know, we still had supplier inventory and we still had suppliers that we owed money to. And if I chose to let the business go into liquidation, the way that our investment was structured from all of our investors, there would likely have been no remuneration to the suppliers at all. And I built personal relationships with almost everyone in this business. And this was not a position we found ourselves in because any sort of, like, malicious intent. I want to be, like, very clear about that. We knew we were going to need more money and to raise additional capital to continue the business. It was just an unfortunate confluence of a lot of things within the market, the interest rate environment, the risk factors associated with venture capital and private equity capital and growth equity capital. But the one for sure was, if I did not try to save the business and find a pathway through, then it would be the worst possible outcome for the category. And so that was my starting point, basically.
With that in mind, as you started balancing, as you mentioned, you had your suppliers and your brand partners and your friends to on one hand, you had your investors on another, and then because retail, you had the landlords and other things that might go into it. How did you balance the needs of all of these, especially knowing that your goal ultimately was you wanted to bring this back and be able to figure out what the second version of this business would be?
Yeah. I think in sort of the terms of, like, hierarchy of needs, the first thing that I started doing when we announced the bankruptcy, I posted something on LinkedIn. I had told everyone that worked with us at Boisson that if there was anything that I could do to help them be a reference, find them a job, et cetera, I would do anything to help everyone that had helped us. The second thing that I did was to start to reach out to the brands that we worked with and basically spend some time explaining to them what I was going to try to do so that there was a little bit more of an understanding that, like, in the bankruptcy process, which I hope nobody ever has to go through, but in the process, there's just so much paperwork that all of the creditors and everyone else were getting. It's easy to just lose sight of the stuff that's, like, actually really important to do. And so it's trying to keep that top of mind for everyone. But it really, like, it started first and foremost with the people. Then it moved to, okay, what is the outstanding exposure that the company has? And where is it that we need to focus our efforts on first? And so the first hurdle was, I've got a group of investors. They have a secured debt position, basically, in the business. And if they don't move their secured debt position out of the way, then there is no way in bankruptcy, because they're a secured creditor and everyone else is an unsecured creditor. There is no way at all for any money that is recovered or made from the business being sold or otherwise reorganized that any supplier or unsecured creditor would get before them. And so the first thing I did was I went to them and said, if I find someone that is interested in recapitalizing this company and say pathway forward, would you accept equity in a reorganized entity in exchange for the debt position that you have in the current entity? And so that is a big enough hurdle in and of itself. The second piece was, when I posted that post on LinkedIn, I basically said, look, I still fundamentally believe in the vision that we set forth here. There are a lot of things about this business that are going to have to change, but I believe there's a pathway forward. If you're interested in it, reach out. Turn my phone off for a few days to just try to spend some time with my family. And I turned it back on, and I've got 500 emails and 400 messages in my LinkedIn inbox and a 250,000 views on LinkedIn. And people are commenting and saying, maybe there's this, or tagging people and whatnot. And I had somebody reach out, and the person that reached out was part of a family office. And they said, listen, like, we've been looking at this space for a while. We thought we had missed the opportunity with you, but if you're interested, we'd really love to dig in. And so before I even had the first conversation, I was like, listen, this is the position that the company is in right now. You need to understand that and go into this eyes wide open. And they did. And so I'll pause, because I'm sure that there's probably a lot more to unpack there. And I realize I'm giving you this really long story, but those first two hurdles were the ones that, like, if we ran face first into, there was no pathway beyond that.
Talent is a big part of predicting the turn. And as we talk about talent, I wanted to mention one of our sponsors, Hunt Club. Imagine the power of the best marketers in the world helping you to find your next marketing leader. That's the power of Hunt Club. Hunt Club is a new category of talent company that powers the network of experts, connectors, and business leaders to help you find the best talent. Let's face it, recruiting hasn't changed with the times. Hunt Club is changing the recruiting game by leveraging technology and crowdsource referrals to find you the best people possible for your company. Stop paying job boards that don't work or recruiting firms that recycle the same active candidates. Partner with Hunt Club.
There's a really interesting lesson there around transparency, because a lot of times founders, you have this belief that you have to be strong and not show the weakness. Yet if you hadn't been transparent and shared that on LinkedIn, that investor never would have been somebody you connected with. How do you think about that? Is the lessons you've taken away, and as you talk to other founders about what you went through?
Yeah, I think we are definitely in the golden era of, it seems to me like companies find themselves spending money on founder PR rather than business PR half the time. I see these like big personal personas about the founder or the CEO. And I think in a lot of businesses, what that actually manifests itself as is faux transparency. I think, and I also think that there are a lot of times that I don't think there's any question in my mind that I certainly believe I'm employable. And I think I probably have a lot to give to a number of organizations that I might go and work for. And I was worried about how I was going to pay my rent the next month and take care of my daughter and face my wife. But I was doing the same thing that all my employees that just lost their job was doing. And they're all having to get out and say, hey, my company just went under. I'm looking for a job. I think it would have been, I didn't look at it as much as like transparency as just the next logical step for me, because I wouldn't want anyone out looking for a job to be also straddled with, well, I wonder in the back of their mind as a new employer saying, I wonder if these people that I'm hiring or interviewing had something to do with the bankruptcy. Was it whose fault was it? Like, I would rather be the lightning rod of the blame than allow others to share that burden or be forced to share that burden because of my silence. And I also think that in a small enough industry as this one, it does no good to hide behind speak or anything else. And so once I wasn't employed by the company anymore, and I was a board member of a company that's in bankruptcy, I didn't really need to do a lot of checking on whether it was okay if I posted or said these things. And I felt like I built in public, and it made sense to try to save what we had built or rebuild in public. I don't know if that answers your question, but I hope others will do the same, because going to LinkedIn and starting every post with I'm extremely excited or profoundly happy to announce is not actually super helpful for pats on the back. Like, I found it to be a community that both holds to account and has also provided me an incredible amount of personal connection. And this is a perfect example of that.
Now that you're at this next phase, what's it look like that the business is reorganized? What comes next?
Yeah, so a number of things have changed. So obviously, our feeling is that specialty retail, especially multi-unit specialty retail, is not going to be a long-term sustainable business for this category, and not for the reason that, like, no one is interested in it. What I mean is that if you've got, for example, a passion in this category and you open a store that you run yourself and that becomes your job or your side project, or it's a large portion of your day, it's possible that the unit economics make sense. But if you actually just break down running a retail store in 2024 with the gross margins that exist, the margin dollars that exist in this business, the foot traffic that you can possibly get into the business in a day, the marketing required to sustain that, the insurance, rent, overhead, et cetera, what you're left with, even in the absolute best of times. We had a retail store in Brooklyn, our original retail store was 480 square feet and was going to do about $1 million this year on its trajectory in 480 square feet. And there are a lot of retail people that would look at that and be like, wow, that is exactly what you want. But that store would have netted the business about maybe $90,000 in EBITDA. So you start looking at that and you're like, wow, you've got dozens of employees across our retail operations. You've got multiple landlords and insurance in multiple states and HR and providing benefits in multiple states, like everything else for these very small niche locations. And you're doing it that if you get 20, you might generate $1.5 million or $1 million in profit. And then you look at the other side of that and you realize that you've actually got a wholesale business that, if on, can use the scale of our consumer platform, which is over 250,000 customers now in our e-commerce platform. We can use our know-how from the new family office that we have on the import and distribution side. If we can set up an on-premise sales team in key markets that we've already been able to do in New York and are looking to do elsewhere. And if we can help in this fundraising environment, and that's the key part. If we can help the second wave of non-alc brands that are not going out and raising $8 and $10 million rounds and are instead trying to grow slower and enter the US market, if you think about Boisson as being this hub and spoke where we can warehouse their products, get them through the FDA compliance hurdles, we can help them power their direct-to-consumer website when they want to launch in the US, we can present them into the best bars and restaurants in New York and other markets, we can help them get into grocery and other distributors networks across the country, we can help them launch their product in the US without having to put 8 or 10 full-time employees on the ground before they've ever sold a single product. That's a pretty compelling way to say maybe they don't need to raise as much money or to put as much risk out there before they understand where maybe the channels are that they're seeing the most traction. And then we can continue to help them as they grow with the full understanding, by the way, that the way that they grow may be beyond just the four walls of what can offer. But if we're there when the smoke happens before fire, I spend my time now at BCB in Berlin and at Provine in Dusseldorf and in Wine Paris, like looking at the products that are coming to market. I want to help bring those new brands to market early. And I think that's where we find ourselves now being the most benefit to the broader category, is that we can help new brands grow and scale more efficiently without having to raise as much capital. That is a very long way of answering your question, but that is the succinct single line of what we are trying to do. Our e-commerce marketplace, our wholesale hub and spoke system, we can help the second wave of non-alc brands find their route to market more efficiently with less capital.
You mentioned a lot about the new brands, the second generation of non-alc brands. What's the relationship with those brands that worked with the first version of your business, and where do they stand with this new version of you?
I think the first thing that I would say is that the relationships that we're building now are much more reasonable. Like, we're not suggesting nationwide distribution in the first year. We're not suggesting any of those things. And many of those brands have not built board decks for large venture capital firms that show that hockey stick curve of we just continue doubling. I have never felt more heard than seeing that meme of that guy that said, my daughter has gone from 8 pounds to 21 pounds. And by this time in 3 years, she'll be 2.7 trillion pounds. Like I've never felt more heard than seeing that meme now, because expectation setting about sustainable growth and the way to think about scaling the business is the most fundamental shift that we've had for how we deal with those brands. But we set the expectation up front that it's very likely that we're going to continue to work together, maybe as importers. When you get a distributor in a part of the country we're not in, we can still help you get the product there. But that's a good thing for all of us that you're getting that product into more places. And that's been a fundamental shift just in the expectation setting that we have with these brands.
Thinking about what the future holds, you mentioned the category and everything else a few times. What makes you most excited about what the future of the NA space has?
I think that I have seen an acceleration, not deceleration, in product innovation. And I think if you look back to the real bellwether of the category is someone like Bill and John at Athletic Brewing, the product innovation, the quality of their beer being better than the O'Doul's that sat dusty in the back of the bar, that was when people went, you know what? I will try an NA beer because it's actually really good. That's happening across the whole category now.
So how has your role as a founder changed as you go into this next version of the business?
Yeah, I'm spending a lot more time now on these relationships that we're building with brands that are coming into the US, but I'm also spending a lot of time with the brands that brought us here and how we can make it right over time. The bankruptcy plan means that there is a payment that we make to the suppliers and to everyone that's a general unsecured creditor, including landlords and everyone else. But we have to continue to do business with the suppliers. And so working on ways that we can do things with each of them to make it right, because ultimately the decision whether or not a supplier wants to do business with us again is, it can be an emotional decision, because there's a lot of emotion in building a business from scratch that is a founder-led business, but it's ultimately a commercial decision, right? Do you think that your brand can sell more product because you do business with us? Yes or no? And if the answer is yes, then we need to find a way to make it right so that you feel like we have acknowledged the challenges in the past. We have acknowledged the amounts that are owed and how we can make that right over time. And a lot of my day now is spent doing that. And then I think to a little bit of your question about like, questions for other founders. I've had a lot of founders, Dave, that have reached out that were like, man, dude, I was so close to the same thing, or this is about to happen to us. What can you tell me about it? I've had funds reach out to me that are like, how did you end up making sure that the original funds still ended up with equity? And like, I've gotten a lot of like, how do we navigate through this in the same way that you navigated through this? And my general instinct is to be as transparent with them as I was through this process about, I think that what we ended up architecting here is a better outcome than watching the business go into Chapter 7 liquidation. I certainly would not still be working as hard as I am if that was the case. And so the real question that I've told everyone that's reached out is, do you believe that you made a strategic error that has caused you to get into the situation you're in? And do you believe that there is a fundamentally sound business at the end of this tunnel that you can't see the light at yet? And if the answer is yes, then it's worth fighting for. If the answer is no, to your point, 90% of startups fail, lots of them within the first 3 years. I think you can go and look at the statistics of Series A companies, Series B companies, Series C companies. I think Uber burned through $51 billion in cash before they got to a profitable quarter. And now they're finally profitable and whatnot. But like, getting people to think about ways that non-alcoholic drinks can integrate into their lives, even if they're not choosing to give up drinking, but just taking a more mindful approach, which is 90% of our customers. Changing the behavior and understanding how they map to an occasion is a very expensive thing to do on a purely customer acquisition basis. Getting customers, if you use the pained analogy of Uber, getting them to look down at an app on their phone instead of raising their hand to hail a cab is an incredibly expensive behavior change. Everyone that comes to market after that benefits from the behavior change that they spent the money to train consumers to be willing to do. And so I'd like to think that if nothing else comes out of our existence in retail, we helped hundreds of thousands of people find NA for the first time, and that getting somebody to try really good non-alc options now will be less expensive for brands that are coming to market and more effective than it was at the beginning because we were there. That's my hope.
Well, I think that's a great place to end the conversation. So I appreciate you, sitting down and being so open with founders about the journey you've been on and why you're excited for what comes next.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me and thanks for the questions. It's not been the best couple of months, but I'm really glad that we found an outcome like this.
Excited to see where it goes.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like the show, hit that rating and make sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And for more resources, head over to predictingtheturn.com.